Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Buckhead Business Radio Show.
All right, Rich Casanova here, your host for another exciting episode of Buckhead Business Radio. We're in the studios here overlooking our million-dollar view of Buckhead. It started out a little bit misty this morning, but things are looking great and just enjoying a beautiful August here in the amazing city of Atlanta, international city from around the world. Listeners here tuning in, so welcome to the show. You're going to really enjoy our guest here this morning, and we have joining us in the studio, as always, our sidekick or producer, engineer, whatever hat you want to pick, Ryan Red Hawk McPherson. Welcome to the studio and the show.
Thank you so much for having me once again, Rich, and it is a pleasure to be here on another fine Tuesday and another great episode of Buckhead Business Radio. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this one.
Absolutely. We had a couple of great shows this week already. We had, of course, Atlanta Legal Experts. Yesterday, you were out doing some other things amongst the city, but we had an interesting conversation with one of the services that we use. Speaking of accounting, we use a very limited cloud book service on cloud, which is FreshBooks, which is a very simple accounting system. And they flew in from Toronto. They were here at the Apple store doing a presentation yesterday. So I reached out to them. I said, hey, y'all, we can see you from the studio. Come on over. So they came on the show and an interesting guest. And you've got Georgia Business Radio coming up on Friday.
That's right. This Friday, we're going to have an interesting conversation about medical marijuana and how it's changing here in Georgia.
That's
we're
right.
Calling it our cannabis show.
Yeah, so the whole show.
Four guests all working inside that industry and bringing that to the forefront here in Georgia. So make sure you tune in Friday, 10 a.m. for another episode of Georgia Business Radio.
And are the dogs coming in? Or are we going to have security? Or samples?
Yeah, no, we'll see how that goes, but certainly going to be very interesting to hear how that is evolving here in Georgia.
Yeah, and one quick teaser, at the end of the show, we'll kind of announce some other shows coming up, but we have a new show launching next week as Wantrepreneur Radio.
What does that mean?
Well, it's for those folks that want to move from being a wantrepreneur to an entrepreneur.
Okay.
Mark Mayette.
Yep. Who we've done some work for on On-Site Business Radio.
Right.
And looking forward to that. So he's launching. What day is that?
It's next Thursday.
Okay.
Or until the 27th, yeah. This Thursday. So we'll have other announcements coming up at the end of the show. But let's jump into the folks we have joining us in the studio this morning for this episode. Ryan, you want to kind of say hi to our guests?
Yeah, our first guest that we'd like to introduce is Mr. Terrence Ross. He is the founder of Rita 2.0. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Ryan.
My pleasure. Tell us a little bit about Rita 2.0.
It's a great software that's designed to teach nonprofit organizations how to generate income rather than relying on grants and contributions to sustain itself. And what I love about this is it's a software with a social conscience.
Oh, I like it. That's great. So, and that's just coming to market?
It is. Matter of fact, we actually launched through the beta testing August 1st of this year.
Okay.
It took us 2 years to build it and probably thousands of nonprofits that we've gone through in order to kind of help fill that gap of becoming sustainable. Rather than relying on just grants and contributions in order to keep the organization afloat.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to hearing more about that in detail. So please stick with us here as we turn our attention to our next guest in the studio, Mr. Aaron Beam. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well.
Good. And you were the founder and the first chief financial officer of Health South. Is that right?
I was.
Right. And you've got a new book that you've just written and coming out?
Yes, Ethics Playbook.
Okay.
And it's a book to help people understand how large corporate frauds happen, why they happen, who the players are, and then what can you do as an individual and a company to prevent unethical business behavior in your company.
Well, very interesting book, and you certainly have a lot of information to share. We look forward to hearing more about that. So please just hold on for a moment as we now turn our attention to Karen Fortune. She is partner at IAG Forensics and Valuation. She has been in the litigation and services practices for over 20 years, comprised of both public and private practice. Having spent several years in the public accounting and servicing as a CFO for a biotechnology firm, she possesses an extensive experience in financial reporting, auditing of both public and private companies, addressing complex accounting issues, evaluating and designing internal controls, and performing corporate investigations. Welcome to the show, Karen Fortune.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Our pleasure. So, Rich, that is our lineup, and take it away.
Oh, man, we got a great one. And interesting, if you haven't already picked up on, is that our first two guests, I'm sure y'all were chatting in the lobby beforehand, right?
Yeah, we sure were.
We were teasing early. We'll just leave the studio, let you guys take over the show here, right?
Yeah.
It's an odd coincidence. sense that we should have you both in the studio. So, well, let's jump in with Karen. First of all, I meant to mention early beforehand, I've known George Dyke for years, right? With your firm there, right? And,
yes.
So how long have you been there?
I actually joined the firm back in 2011.
Okay.
So about 4 years.
Yeah. So I've met George years ago, networking, and run into him quite often. And very first time I was at a networking event, he was, just introduced ourselves. And I understand he was in CPA and accounting, and you meet a lot of those folks, right? But he had said forensic accounting.
Right.
That got my attention. I never really kind of knew that as a specific niche business and industry, but it's huge.
It's a great niche to be in. It's a lot of fun. It's really interesting. And forensic, what that means
right.
is suitable for court. So everything that we do, whether it's gathering information in the context of a fraud investigation or if it's helping in a litigation context, it's all suitable for court. So you have evidentiary requirements that you have to adhere to, and it's a different way of looking at accounting.
So give us a little bit of backstory on IAG Forensics and Evaluation for those folks that may not have heard about or are familiar with that that type of business.
Sure.
How do you explain it to folks?
How I explain it to folks is that we are a CPA firm, but we don't do taxes or regular audits. What we do is we assist people with forensic accounting, fraud investigation, and litigation support needs. And we also help with business valuation. So if you're going through a transaction, you want to buy a business, that type of thing, we can also help you with the business valuation end of it.
And that definitely gets the attention of a lot of our listeners, obviously, on business radio. So a lot of small businesses. Who are your typical clients or range, or who's best in your wheelhouse as far as business valuation?
In terms of business valuation, it can be different types of clients. We have business valuation clients that are going through transactions, and they can be a small family-owned business all the way up to large publicly held companies that are looking at buying a private company.
Right.
So you can have a business transaction that you're looking to value. You can also have a situation where you have intangibles for financial reporting and you need them to be valued. So your customer list, your trademarks, different assets of the company that you need valued for financial reporting purposes.
Right.
And we can help with that. And then on the other more interesting side, right. sometimes, you can have a divorce situation even where a couple is going through a divorce. They have family-owned business and somebody's going to end up with the business. Someone's going to leave the business. And so you have to figure out what's the value so you can split it equitably.
Since you mentioned that, because on this morning show for Atlanta Legal Experts, there was a conversation about folks that go through a divorce. And once that's a traumatic experience and maybe months or years and just a lot of turmoil and stress, and once it's kind of done, the attorney said it's kind of a sigh of relief, and they kind of feel they move on with their life. But many times they forget to take their former spouse off of some of these legal documents.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You run into that? Or
We typically leave that to the attorneys to take care of, but that certainly has been an issue. And in my fraud investigations, there are many times, not only in a divorce situation, but when you have former employees that
right.
leave a company and they still have access.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
so you have that type of situation where they can still access the books and records. They have remote access into the accounting system, the banking system, that type of thing. We find that that can be a big risk to companies as well.
Yeah, I get that now from a business perspective, because after someone's been there for a period of time, they have keys to the
Kingdom.
Yeah, to the kingdom.
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. And the passcodes and all. And you kind of forget after you have so many moving parts to your business of all those different entry points to important parts of your business and who has access. And you let someone go and you probably check off a few of those. But if you leave a window open, right?
Yes. Yes. And people, if they want to, they can go through those windows.
Yeah.
Yep.
But back to the valuation of a business. What's the smallest to the largest? I mean, because obviously you're not dealing with a Delta Airlines or a global company of that scope, right? So what's in your kind of, in your lane?
Well, I don't do business valuations.
Or as far as the firm, I guess, yeah.
As far as the firm.
You may or may not know that because that's not true.
Yeah,
you don't wear that hat. So
my colleagues have worked on, like I say, the small mom and pop shops all the way up to public companies that have financial reporting issues. So it can be really anywhere in that range.
Okay. So let's talk about risk and fraud.
Sure.
All right. What are some, well, everybody got all excited about that. Yeah. Ryan, actually, what did you say earlier? Like, she's not investigating you?
Yeah, right? I hope not.
Yeah. You probably get that a lot. People get nervous. It's like when the IRS calls or whatever, right?
It's never good when we are called on the scene, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Well, who typically calls you onto the scene?
Typically, we're called by the attorneys.
Okay.
So something has gone wrong at a firm, whether it's a situation where you have an employee or a former employee or a business partner, somebody has suspected that something has been taken or misreported, embezzled, that type of thing, and the attorneys are typically the ones that call
us. And there's
us.
Probably some level of confidentiality when you come on that the employees don't know that's going on because they don't want to, business owners don't want to stir the pot, so to speak. Employees think that, oh man, it's time to get find a new job. When you come on the scene, they may or may not know who you are, but you don't want to certainly announce that the company is now being investigated.
That's true, and that really is an interesting question for the companies to figure out is how do they want to handle it? Do they want it open, and do they want to have the staff know that we're going to take care of this type of situation and have them all aware, or do we come in after hours? Do we do a snatch and grab of records and computers after hours and have the computer forensics team come with us and mirror the hard drives, that type of thing?
So, it could be different for each case.
It really can.
And then does that come back on your recommendation or the owners of the company? Or it kind of both?
It typically is the owners of the company and their attorneys try to figure out how do they want to best handle the situation.
Oh, very good. Well, see, we're speaking with Karen Fortune. She's a partner at IAG Forensics and Valuation. She has testified in both federal and state courts. What was that experience like for you? Do you get nervous?
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
You definitely get nervous because you want to be as prepared as possible with the facts and have complete command of the facts because you're there to assist the jury or the judge in making a fair decision.
So do you walk through an entire investigation from beginning to an end? Or are you kind of juggling three or four investigations at a time? What's like your day-to-day like over there?
We can juggle many projects at a time. So I have a lot of projects going on right now.
Well, I guess that speaks to the culture of business out there that some folks are not doing business the way they should.
Well, bad business is good business for her, right?
Yeah,
that's true.
Guess so.
Keeps write her that in down. Business. Put that on your tell George to put that as a website.
Bad business is good business for IAG and Karen. Yeah.
So who's at risk from fraud?
You know, it's interesting. Everyone is at risk, it seems. We have done investigations for companies. We have done investigations for nonprofits, as you,
really?
Mr. Ross. Yes.
Okay.
So we have done investigations for cities, school systems, you name it.
Healthcare companies, yeah.
We have. Yes, we have. Medical practices in particular, but it can be anybody.
So, so talk to us about, you know, how can somebody prevent there? What's some basic pointers or steps to mitigate some of these issues as a business, you know, owner?
That's a great question. And you said mitigate, and that's important because a lot of folks, I believe, think that they can eliminate the risk. And quite frankly, I don't think you can eliminate the risk of fraud. But to mitigate risk, what we ask our business owners to really think about is to stay in touch with the business side of your business. A lot of business owners are great salespeople. They're visionaries, and they don't want to get mired down in the details. And
delegate, that's delegate, delegate, right?
Exactly. And so they believe that if I turn this function over to somebody I really trust, then all is well. And it's unfortunate that many times it is that very person that you really trust that ends up being the culprit.
So
the factors we ask the folks to employ, I guess, is to simple things like get a copy of the bank statement and the check copies. Look at the checks that are going out. Many times these frauds, you've got checks that are being written to the very people. They're writing checks to themselves. They're writing checks to their husband's business or fake vendors, and they're taking the money. Look at your credit card statements. Take a look and see what is the money being spent on. We sadly have a lot of business corporate credit cards that are being taken to the Pink Pony and golf outings and all kinds of really spectacular places that are really not business related typically.
And should be red flags, right?
They should, yes, absolutely.
I just kind of another one here. Too much delegation will lead to litigation.
Right? There you go.
That's a good one. Write that one down.
Right. Got that one here.
I'm on a roll here. But because I think from what I know of Aaron's story, I think he's going to speak to this in our next segment about, if correct me if I'm wrong, but at one point, HealthSouth had up to 1,500 sets of books going
on. More than that, probably close to 2,000 sets of books.
I mean, that's just mind-boggling, right? I don't think most people would be to that extreme, but that's another kind of issue with companies is that if they're managing multiple different books, right? I mean...
Sure, and different systems. A lot of systems don't integrate well, and so people are not able to see the whole picture.
And if somebody within your organization sees that, it's just an opportunity, right? And people, I think, for the most part, want to do good. But if you kind of give them the doors too wide open, it's just too tempting, right? And they figure, I'll just snag a little bit. You know, it starts out with the coffee mugs and the ink pens and, you know, a little extra here and there or whatever, right? Then all of a sudden, if they feel like no one's looking over their shoulder, I'll just use the credit card this time for, you know, this, I got to cover an expense for myself, right?
Yeah, and it's funny, I do presentations from time to time, and there was a Dilbert book that said, Build a Better Life by Stealing Office Supplies, I think was the title of the comic book. And that can be the way it starts. And then if it's just too lax an environment, it can lead to problems.
Yeah. So talk to us about, we've talked about these issues. What about preventive measures in terms of checking up on companies versus investigating the fraud? What's the balance there? Or
I wish the balance was more even, but we typically are only called in when something bad has happened. Yeah. We have only done a handful of preventative measures and looking at companies and helping them develop their fraud plan and preventative medicine, if you will. So it's typically not believed by business owners that it could happen to them.
Yeah.
And it can happen to anyone. And that's the unfortunate thing.
Yeah, unfortunately, you do get called in like that, is that, like we said, bad business is good business for IAG.
Yeah. Terrence, you got a question for Karen?
Yeah, I do. Karen, what kind of things have you noticed in terms of the forensic audits for nonprofits? Because a lot of times they are very, very, very strong in terms of the technical things that they do.
Right.
And lacking a lot on the business side. And typically that has been forwarded to somebody else. So
right.
What are some of the things you found? And I'm pretty sure it's probably a good range of things.
It is. And one of the things I think for nonprofits, they tend to be very good at mission and very good at delivering their programs. But they a lot of times outsource their accounting functions and really are not aware of what's going on. And if the monies are coming in, contributions, grants, that type of thing, and they're not being tracked properly, then those monies don't necessarily make it to the coffers of the organization. And so that's something to really need to stay on top of, is to understand who's donating funds, where's the money coming from, documenting these are the monies that people are donating, and have a system to capture all of that. Because if there's cash, if there's a way to divert these funds, somebody might figure out how to do that.
And what's amazing about that, because that's exactly what our software does, and it was the catalyst for why we decided to do what we were doing.
I think that's fantastic. Yeah. I think the more that people have software options that are really tailored for their business and not for profits in particular, then I think that's important for them to take a look at, because if they're just trying to put it into a regular accounting package, they may miss what's going on in their organization.
Well, great question, Terrence. I think we just leave the studio, let these guys take it from here, right?
You
got some great questions.
It really all comes together when you think about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't plan it this way, but when it happens this way, we feel pretty good here at Buckhead Business Radio X.
Absolutely. So let's just let our listeners know, if you will, best way to find out about you and your firm and point of contact.
Sure. You can reach us at www.iagforensics.com. And you can reach us also at our Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter, IAG_forensic CPA. And our phone number is 770-565-3000. 3098, and we really appreciate you having us here today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just one follow-up, what does IAG stand for?
Investigative Accounting Group.
How about that? All right.
Good answer or whatever,
yes,
yeah.
Makes sense now. Very good. Well, thank you so much, Karen, for joining us.
Thank you.
We do appreciate that. And we may come back to you for a few more questions at the end. Certainly do chime in if you have some other questions for the other guest. But we'd like to introduce our next guest, Mr. Aaron Beam. He was co-founder and the first chief financial officer of Health South from 1984 until 1997. Today, he lives in Locksley, Alabama, with his wife of 45 years. Her name is Phyllis. In 1996, he took part in the accounting fraud at Health South. In 2003, he pled guilty to the fraud and spent time in federal prison for his crime. He's been in his public speaking career since 2009, and as of June 2015, he has spoken to over 275 different groups, to include universities, associations, companies, and civic groups. His primary message is about corporate fraud, who is actually responsible for these frauds, how they take place, and what can be done to prevent frauds such as Enron and Health South. Mr. Beam is also an author. His first book, Health South, The Wagon to Disaster, was published in 2009. His second book was published in January of this year and is titled Ethics Playbook, Winning Ethically in Business. Welcome to the show, Mr. Aaron Beam.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Rich?
We were talking beforehand the last couple of days about having you on the show, and a very interesting, compelling story on so many different fronts. I think we could do a whole an hour. I know you've been on NPR, and you were on
American Greed.
American Greed. I watched that show. I've never met anybody that's that's been on the show. So let's kind of jump in. I have a copy of your book here. I got this the other day, and I've seen some content on your videos and your interview on NPR on your website. But for those folks, just rewind, if you will. So Health South, I think a lot of people in this area are familiar with it, but outside the market. Tell us, what was the mission and the idea, how that kind of came about?
Well, I was one of the founders of the company, and our niche was that we did things on an outpatient basis. We did rehabilitation and sports medicine on an outpatient basis. We also owned rehab hospitals, which were specialty hospitals. And by the time I left the company, we owned more outpatient surgery centers than any other company in the United States.
Wow.
So we were kind of an alternative to the acute care hospital to lower health care costs by doing things on an outpatient basis.
So, you know, at its heyday, give us some of the stats, like how many hospitals and what kind of volume. And
We had a total number of operating units of about 2,000. We were operating in all 50 states. We had 60,000 employees. We own more rehab hospitals, more surgery centers, and more outpatient centers than any other company. And we were 350th on the Fortune 500 list.
Wow. So how many hospitals? You mentioned in all 50 states, but 2,000, you said?
Hospitals, no.
Outpatient centers.
Outpatient centers, there were probably about 1,000 of those. And then the other 1,000 or so operations were split between surgery centers and hospitals.
But 60,000 employees.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just mind-boggling. Yeah. Right? I can't even think of a company, some of the big ones here in Atlanta, Home Depot, Delta. I don't think they reach those marks. But I was hearing you expected, I think, to hit $1 million, right, in your first year, or what was the stats on that, right? Because you thought you could never reach that point.
Well, we put together a five-year business plan,
right,
when we were raising venture capital, and we projected that we 5 years would be $100 million company.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just silly.
Right.
And I said, we're just doing this to attract money, you know.
Right.
Well, we actually did. Within 5 years, we were $100 million company.
Wow.
We actually hit our numbers from the get-go. Our timing was just right.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you attribute that to?
Timing.
Yeah.
It was just everybody was saying healthcare is too expensive. We've got to do something to lower healthcare costs. So doctors back in the early 80s were keeping patients in the acute care hospital to receive physical therapy.
Wow.
Which is a very expensive way to do it. And today, 60% of all surgeries are done outpatient. And we were right in the very beginning of this boom.
So, and how many years all told was the company around?
Well, it's still around. Believe it or not, unlike Enron and some other companies, okay. When the fraud was exposed, the company did not declare bankruptcy, and it is still in business on the New York Stock Exchange today. It's primarily just a rehab hospital today.
And anybody serious competitor in that space, or they didn't really fill the void because the company just carried on, right?
We were lucky that we got out first. We had the name. We were the leader in the industry, and we were able to stay ahead of our competition.
And I know you're no longer with the company. We definitely want to delve into your books and your backstory, which is very compelling. But just kind of set the stage, a couple more questions on the HealthSouth organization. So fast forward now. Again, you're not affiliated with it, but what's the impact, plus or minus, with affordable health care? How does that impact, or a yes or no?
I've been gone from the company since 97.
Right, yeah.
But I would imagine there's still an effective way to deliver health care at a lower cost. And that's why, unlike Enron, the company survived because it really was a good method of delivering health care.
Yeah, the principles were all in place.
It exactly.
So now let's get into kind of the
what happened.
Right. Yeah. The meat and potatoes here. So again, from what I know, so you had the owner or the co-founder owner, your boss, the guy reported Richard, right? What was his last name?
Scrushy.
Okay. So and there was tell us a little bit about what I recall the conversation about his personality and what kind of started that first, you know, episode of tweaking the books.
Richard was kind of a typical CEO that you see at the center of many of these frauds, like Enron, WorldCom. He had a tremendous ego, very charming in an intimidating kind of way. a person that really was a good leader, a lot of it through intimidation. But unfortunately, he measured success totally by how much money he could accumulate. He told the Birmingham newspapers in the early 90s that he wanted to be a billionaire. He hoped he could become the richest man in the state of Alabama.
Wow.
So his main thing was accumulate wealth.
And at all costs.
At all costs. Right. And unfortunately, when HealthSouth started missing their earnings a little bit, he could just not live with it, and he said, no, we're not going to report bad numbers. You guys fix the numbers.
You feel like it, or he felt like it affected his reputation.
Of course. His ego was so big, he did not want to face Wall Street and say, we've missed our numbers. You know?
Which is not the end of the world, but to him, it was that was his mindset.
That's right.
And so tell us at some juncture, how did this conversation go down, where he basically said, Aaron, you need to take care of this, right?
Well, it was the second quarter of 96. We had missed our numbers. We hadn't released them yet, but we had missed Wall Street expectations. And my controller and I went into his office and said we'd have to report bad numbers. And he just screamed at us, no, get out of my office.
Right.
He said, that's not an option.
Yeah.
He said, you guys have gotten lazy. You're smart guys, and you know how to fix the numbers. Get back in your office and fix these numbers. Unfortunately, go ahead.
When he said fix, he meant.
In his trial, and he was found innocent, the lawyers tried to say by fix, he meant just do your job.
I listened to that part of your interview, and I was telling Ryan earlier about that this morning, is that they pinned you in a corner. And tell your version of the story of how the attorney basically had you on the in the hot seat.
Well, in the courtroom, the lawyer said, when Mr. Scrushy told you to fix the numbers,
right,
isn't it possible that he just was telling you to do your
just
job?
Just do your job. That's your job, right, as a CFO.
I said, no. And the lawyer said, well, did he ask you to commit fraud? I said, yes, he asked me to fix the numbers. No, Mr. Bean.
Exactly.
Did he use the word fraud? Did he ask you to commit fraud? And I said no.
Yeah, because who would use those words, right?
Yeah.
Karen, yes or yes? Yeah, it's not going to happen, right?
It's not going to happen.
But so I had to say, no, he did not use that word.
Dang.
And he looked over at the jury and he says, these guys were asked to do their job, fix the numbers.
We're speaking with Aaron Beam. He's author of the new book, Ethics Playbook, Winning Ethically in Business. When did you know in your heart that you were in trouble?
Well, I certainly knew that day. My controller actually agreed to use those 2,000 different ledgers to make entries small enough and spread them through the ledgers. And he had worked for our auditors, and he knew their threshold for examining entries. And he kept the entries small enough, and they did not discover the fraud. And, of course, at that point, I knew I was in big trouble. Now, and after I look back on everything, I was a coward. It takes courage sometime to be ethical, to stand up and do the right thing. And I did not have the courage at the time to stand up to Richard Scrushy and say, no, we can't do this. And I regret it to this day.
And so for that first day, you knew that this wasn't right. And it went on and on and on.
But it was just going to be one time, though.
Richard's, here's were Richard's words, essentially. Look, guys, we'll only do it once this quarter. Nobody will lose their job. Stockholders won't get hurt. And you guys know everybody does this. And like a fool, I guess I bought into that. Or I didn't have the courage to say no.
Well, it was for the bigger picture, right? So that, you know, everybody would...
Exactly. Help. And that's the interesting thing, and I think Karen would back me up on this. Many times people commit fraud not so much to put money into their pockets immediately, but it's for the good of the company, good of the organization.
Yeah.
They rationalize, and that's a big word in fraud. You rationalize your bad behavior by saying it's in the long run, it's going to be okay.
In the long run, the big picture kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And then like Ryan was saying, so you had your gut feeling, but you are dealing with a Mussolini-type personality is what I'm hearing, right? I mean, it's just like a dictator. Because I think you said it previously that you either basically followed his or you were going to be gone.
In fact, Mussolini is a good word, but I like to tell people if Hannibal Lecter and Richard Scrushy got into a fight, Richard would win.
Wow. That is a good visual,
But you ultimately all caught up with you, and you end up going to court.
Yeah, I left the company in less than a year.
Wow.
And I left in 97, and the fraud was exposed in 2003. And I heard it on television.
And how much volume were they doing at that point? What were their sales?
They were about a $4 billion company at that time.
It's too big to fail, kind of. You know, that came later down the road.
Well, it actually didn't fail.
No, but I'm saying that was probably the mindset of if we just adjust these 2,000 different books or whatever, we're too big, we're not going to go down, we're just going to kind of fix it.
Exactly.
But I find that interesting. You left in 1997, and it wasn't exposed until 2003. So those years that you had left the company, you thought this had been put to bed, so to speak, and then wasn't going to come find you.
Yeah, when I first retired, every time my doorbell rang or the phone rang, I thought it was the FBI. But over time, as so much time passed, I began to believe that it had stopped. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised when I heard it was still going on in 2003.
So then 2003, it all caught up. You went to court. You did your time. And it is all said and done with now. There's no way they can't come after you now, right?
No. I actually did not personally go to court. I pled guilty, so that was it. I was just waiting to be sentenced.
And how
I
long
did
were
take
you...
part in Richard Scrushy's trial, and he was found not guilty.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And how long did you...
I did three months.
Okay, yeah.
Which you'd say, and I believe in many ways that's surprising that I got such a light sentence, but any time in prison is pretty bad black mark on your record. When I got out of prison, I could not get a job.
Oh, yeah.
And but then you began your public speaking career after that?
Well, for 3 years, I mowed lawns for a living.
Really?
You did?
Yeah. Seriously? I mowed lawns.
You had your own landscaping company.
Well, I had a lawnmower.
And did you keep your own records then?
Yeah, I did. And I was honest with people used to pay me in cash, and they'd say, so you don't have to declare it to the IRS. And I said, look, I've been to prison once.
Right.
I'm going to declare everything I get in. So, but after 3 years, I spoke at LSU, my alma mater, and the professor liked it. And by then, the WorldCom, all that was gone, but the subprime debacle took place. And I got on the internet and I discovered that universities were scrambling to teach ethics in their schools. And tomorrow I'm speaking at Kennesaw State to the accounting students about ethics and how you prevent fraud. And that's what my book is about.
Right. And so you wrote that first book, which is about the healthcare, Health South and the Wagon to Disaster in 2009.
Right.
And you've gone on to write another book, which you just wrote this year. What's that writing experience like for you?
You know, I never dreamed that I could ever write a book, but I found it was a good discipline to sit down because I was already doing my public speaking. And I just put on paper what I was saying in my speeches, and I enjoyed the process.
Yeah, do you sit down every day and say, I'm going to write from such and such time to this time, or do you actually go away to the mountain cabin and lock yourself up for a week and write? I mean, how's that for you?
I found that I would try to psych myself up. I would, the night before I go to bed, I'd say, now tomorrow I'm going to write on my book, and if I really worked at it, I could. So, but it's a difficult thing to write a book.
That's what I understand. I mean, would you, like Ryan would say, would you have a goal for like one chapter for that day, or just a certain topic or a point to cover?
Yes, yeah. I would have a topic that I wanted to cover, and I'd try to cover it, and then I submitted it to my editor, who would clean up my English and grammar and spelling and that kind of thing.
Well, we've had several authors here in the studio, and they all have different ways of writing the book. Yeah. Some of them write it themselves. Some people employ a ghostwriter. Others write with others and in combination to put that book together. So it's different for each person. It's good to get a little insight from you. And let's talk about your book, Ethics, the Playbook for Ethics Playbook, Winning Ethically in Business. So what can readers expect from this book?
Well, first off, I go into how, and it's primarily about the large corporate frauds, the Enrons, WorldComs, HealthSouth, and it's about how these frauds happen, why they happen, and when you have frauds like Enron that go on for years and amount to billions of dollars, there are hundreds of people involved. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of players. For a fraud to go on that long, the CEO is probably at the center of it. The accounting people get involved. The auditors may not be involved, but they don't do their job. The board of directors don't do their job. Employees are afraid to be whistleblowers, so they participate. So society in general is even part of the problem. Enron was voted the best company in the United States 3 years in a row for Fortune magazine.
Wow.
Right before they crashed. So a lot of times these CEOs begin to believe their own press, and they begin to believe they're above the law. And so society is part of the problem. And I even think somehow, even though I can't prove it, I think the Kardashians are part of the problem.
I'd buy into that.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the book, Ethics Playbook. What's the takeaway from that, from a reader's perspective? Yeah.
I hope the takeaway is that people will realize that being ethical is just like being a good athlete. You have to work at it. You have to practice it. You have to build ethical strength. I tell college students when they go out, if they're accounting majors, that they need to have their eyes open and know that one day there's a high probability they will be asked to commit fraud.
Really?
And they need to understand the circumstances. They need to have studied Enron, WorldCom, all these things, so they know what to do when they're asked. They won't be there like a deer in a headlight. They will have practice in little things being ethical, and they'll have the ethical strength to stand up and do the right thing.
That's a very interesting perspective. You don't think about take a proactive approach and a preventive to anticipate that this is reality. It's going to come across your desk at some point.
You have to do it. When that pilot landed that plane on the Hudson River.
Right. Sully.
In the middle of New York City with no engines, full of passengers, he landed it on a river in New York City and nobody even got hurt. And when they asked him how he could do it, he said, I prepared all my life for this event.
Wow.
I studied every airplane crash, every water landing. When those birds flew into my engine, I knew what to do. I tell students, birds will fly into your engine one day, and you need to be prepared and know what to do.
That's right. In the Army, we call that a battle drill. So you prepare for things that you don't have to think about doing
exactly.
It. And then when it happens, you act almost on instinct for that. And all this conversation reminds me of another core value that I was taught in the Army, integrity. Doing the right thing when no one's looking.
Exactly.
And someone's always looking. So if you're going to do something wrong, it will catch up with you. But integrity is a big part of that.
Prior to today's show, I probably won't. I'm going to retire this line I used to use at networking events, right? I would just, in a cocktail talk, I would say, in business, it's very important to be ethical whenever possible.
But
it's always possible. You should always be ethical.
That's the joke. When it works in your advantage, you should be ethical. Yeah,
you're right. It comes back to that old saying, you know, you're going to take copy paper from the company to go home and make copies. Yeah. But would you take money out of the kitty jar to go home and buy yourself copy paper? You know, you're in both ways. You're not doing the right thing, but it could eventually catch it because it starts small and then it builds from there. And before you know it, you're scamming the entire company.
But it is tough because it's kind of like that white lie kind of thing, you know, someone ask, you know, how they look. Oh, you look great, you know, but you really could have said something different, right? So, I mean, it's tough maybe, but so you have a couple other thoughts here?
The book, if I might.
Absolutely.
You can buy it on Amazon.
Okay.
Either the digital version or hard copy, or you can buy it directly from my website.
Yeah, and what's that site?
It's aaronbeam.net. Mm-hmm. A-A-R-O-N, last name Beam, B-E-A-M.
It should be required reading for a lot of these business students out there.
A few universities have actually picked it up as a textbook college students. So yeah. I'm very proud of that.
Big time. Yeah, I would definitely think so. Aaron, it's been like a very intriguing conversation and just hearing your backstory and just the little snippet that we got here this morning. Hang tight. We're going to have another guest here and we'll probably have a little bit of roundtable here discussion. I know Karen's probably chomping at the bit for some questions, but I know you've been nodding your head through most of the interview. And so just remind our listeners once again, best way to reach and find out about you is that website right there?
The website. And I'm very Googleable.
Okay, Googleable. That's a good one.
if you forget everything, Google me, and information will come up.
Okay, perfect. So, Ryan, who's our anchor man here in the studio?
The guy's going to kind of play cleanup for us here and take us on home. Terrence Ross is the founder of Rita 2.0, where nonprofits come to grow, social engineering software company that specializes in working with nonprofit organizations using enterprise ideas to address social problems, create sustainability, and promote social responsibility. Rita Tech's mission is to teach nonprofit organizations how to sustain themselves financially through the social enterprise activities rather than relying solely on grants and donations. Since there are no shareholders in a nonprofit organization, the revenue from the business-related activities are completely reinvested in the work of the organization, thereby teaching nonprofit organizations how to use a business solution to solve a social problem. The cloud-based software has been designed and created by Terrence Nicholas Ross, known as the Dean of Nonprofits. He's an author, educator, and social engineer and has over 15 years' experience working with and training nonprofit founders on developing, growing, and running a successful nonprofit organization. Welcome to the studio, Terrence Ross.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Rich?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Thanks for being patient. An interesting conversation so far, right? Yes or yes?
Both yes.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. And so talk to us about how did you kind of, all these years into nonprofit, tell us a little bit about your background prior to that.
You know, one of the things that happened, just like any other nonprofit, you know, we were moving along extremely well at some point. And all of a sudden, money started to drop for a lot of different reasons, whether it be the economy or just simply the concept that we were using just was no longer attractive. And no nonprofit wants to hear that.
Right.
And I started doing research about 10 years ago on why some nonprofits succeed, while others fail. And one of the things that I found out was so amazing because it went against the absolute grain of what we've been taught in the nonprofit arena, which was nonprofits are traditionally successful when they have a product and a service, all right? Something that they could also offer to the general public. As long as those capitals go back into the general coffin, then that money obviously wouldn't be taxable, number one. But number two, it would be business-related activities, so the IRS wouldn't have a problem. So when I started studying this thing, I started looking at companies like Goodwill, who have thrift stores, the
Girl
Scout sells cookies, the Boy Scouts have uniforms. All of these great nonprofits had a product and a service. So for a company like ours who only had a service, and that service did nothing but beg for capital and give away the service, it was a bad business model, believe it or not, Aaron. It was a very bad business model. And so we started thinking to ourselves, what could we do differently? So we started looking into the notion of social enterprising. And it was went against the grain of what we've been taught because nonprofits are not supposed to make money. So that was very taboo for us. But what the federal government says is that a nonprofit can't make a profit. It can generate income as long as that income is business related and it goes into the general coffin. So we started looking at ways of saying, wow, if we're going through this problem, then other nonprofits must be having the same issues.
Yeah, because it's I was thinking about this earlier. So it's a bit of an oxymoron so that if a nonprofit makes a profit, they're unsuccessful. Right? Because that's not their mission, right?
It's certainly not the function of what a nonprofit is designed to do.
Yeah. But the idea is to take that profit and to do the good work that their intention or their mission is, right?
Correct. And one of the things that we found out was a lot of the principles of accounting along with the business development arms of the social engineering portion of that was lost in translation. Because most nonprofit founders were taught about their mission. They really had very little business sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were kind of talking about before with some of our other guests, is that everybody wears these different hats, and they're not necessarily all different departments, and they're not talking to each other.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Is that one of the challenges, I mean, with most businesses, but what's kind of unique, I guess, maybe a bigger picture question, what are some unique challenges to nonprofits that don't typically appear in a for-profit company?
First of all is that when income comes into a for-profit company, you can pretty much use it the way you want to use it, just so that you report it ethically.
Keep it legal, legit.
But for nonprofits, when that capital comes in from somebody else, it's already been pre-designated on how you could spend it. I always tell people a joke of a nonprofit I served on board for a number of years here locally. And let me tell you what was amazing about that. We had capital that we could literally go buy another building with, but we didn't have enough capital to fix the roof on the building we were in because the money had to be allocated the way it was allocated. So with that being said, one of the things that we found out in our research is that a lot of nonprofits simply just didn't have the tools necessary in order to develop these social enterprise ideas. And they certainly didn't have the software capacity in order to capture that. You used to have to do this in many different software. Obviously, QuickBooks and those kind of things were something on the table, but it was just too far advanced for the average nonprofit founder. You needed to have a CPA background in order to understand some of that.
So, Terrence, I think you just set me up for my next question. Yeah, so tell us about Rita 2.0 and the software. Where do y'all come in?
Let me tell you, I love the space that we're in right now. It's awesome. I think Rita 2.0 is probably the first software that mixes the principles of accounting with the business development arm of social enterprise. It also allows the nonprofit to be able to really capture all of the facets of the nonprofit's function in a technology format. And it kind of forces you to do the business side every day. And what I love about this process is when you first log onto our system, it gives you an opportunity to take your organization through what I like to call an assessment tool. And it evaluates every format of the nonprofit from its leadership all the way down to how it receives its capital. And it lets you know where the holes in the organization are at that point. It also has a great way of looking at your board of directors and making sure that you have an opportunity to be able to access them and to find out what they're contributing back to the organization. We also have a social enterprise audit piece, believe it or not. It's not in form of accounting, but it is on the business development where we start looking at the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. We start looking at the products and services that they have. We look at their new offering as what it relates to their mission. And then it also gives a sustainability. And it lets you know in the black or red if what you're providing this year is going to be in the black or the red. This also allows the organization to know now exactly what they need to do in order to meet their goals financially.
Seems like these days there's more 501c3s out there popping up every single day. It's almost like charity is everywhere for anything, whether it's homeless pets, homeless people, you know, businesses, whatever. So what is your Rita 2.0? Can you help everyone from the smalls?
You're absolutely right.
Who are your typical clients or your best type of clients?
Believe it or not, they could be anywhere from traditional 501c3s to CHOTOs to athletes who mm-hmm. have foundations. It certainly could work with PTOs. It could work with motorcycle clubs. It could work with, you know, cancer survivor organizations. So what we did was we designed a software that was going to be simple enough to make sure that all the things that the IRS were requiring, that funders could be requiring, that even things that you should be reporting on, just to make sure that you have a good foundation for your board of directors to know. This software allows you to do that. And I think it's very interesting is that most nonprofit founders didn't like using software for anything other than reporting. So anything else was then forfeited to somebody else. This allows the nonprofit founder to stay ahead of the game.
And so if someone needs these services, I mean, do they have to meet with you, or can it be all done via the computer? You know, so you can help anyone around the country, apparently.
That's exactly right. Both ways, believe it or not, inside of the software, it also allows you to be able to contact us if there's any support that may be needed in terms of what goes into the software.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put Karen on the spot here in a minute because this is a little bit over my head. You've been in this space for many, many years from a CPA perspective. I'm going to call on you just a second, maybe ask some questions in terms of the operation of the accounting for the RITA 2.0 software. But so what I'm hearing, or what we're talking about, is the ideal client. So back to kind of who's in your wheelhouse. And we had these folks I mentioned earlier they flew in from Toronto yesterday, and they did a presentation at the Apple Store over here for their accounting service, which is the FreshBooks. It's an online accounting service just for businesses, and obviously not for nonprofits, but maybe there's a tie in here. But they deal in 120 countries, over 10 million users, and we're one of them. And but the presentation, what I respected is they said, if your business is at a HealthSouth or not even at that level, but if you're this, you know, beyond a certain space, is that they recommend QuickBooks, you know, because their software has limitations or, you know, stays in a certain sandbox, which is perfect for businesses, maybe 50, 100 employees or whatever the benchmark is. So that's a long-winded question to ask you and Karen or yourself as far as... with RITA 2.0, is it local charities anywhere in the country, but it's not necessarily the American Cancer Society. A lot of those have internal programs. And so where's your space?
Correct. We actually have this software that's going to be developed in three different spaces. It's going to be basic, which is what we're talking about today. It's going to be pro. Obviously, it's going to be the second level. And then the third level, obviously, is going to be the enterprise one for larger nonprofits like you mentioned. Right now, this first basic piece, we're trying to keep it for the sweet spot of 250,000 below, less than 10 employees. You've been in business for at least 5 years or less. These are the people for our basic model that probably right. could use this software the most. It's the people who probably have not been in business long enough to understand the other side of the house.
Right, right. Or don't have all those issues at this point.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Correct.
And then what's the other two boxes?
And the pro version of that is going to be a nonprofit that has a coffin somewhere around $300,000 or less.
Okay.
Who does need a little bit more of the accounting portion in terms of chronicling all the major dollars that are coming in that has some of the business aspects already in place. So that group right there is using us for a different reason. And that reason really is to make sure that the dollars that are coming in, whether somebody's giving it to you in the form of a gift or something that came in the form of a donation or a grant, can now have an opportunity to be chronicled in a way that you can email those reports out, and is only for the space that you're in. You don't have to co-mingle with other things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Karen, great.
Yeah. I had a question for you. Typically, when we're doing our fraud investigations that involve not-for-profits, it's as a result of a lack of sophistication on the part of management, if you will. And so what I think I'm hearing from you is that your product or your software accounts for the fact that some folks don't have that accounting degree or that finance background.
Absolutely.
And great question, Karen.
Yeah, that's an absolute great question. And I tell you, the reason why we looked at this process is that because in the accounting world, obviously on the for-profit side, you assume that the CEO has a CFO that you can go to and get all of these things done, and it works out. In the nonprofit world, we typically wear multiple hats. So the most that we have in accounting is what the grant funder says you need to be able to report back every month. Okay, and making sure that we can meet payroll. In this particular software, it reminds them that there is a business side of the house that has to take place, and there is some accounting portion that you're responsible for, even if you don't do the function every day.
Gotcha. And I had one other question. As a number of business people tend to sit on boards, and a lot of us have a financial background, so we're asked to be part of the finance committees. is this product, does it give the management and the board better reporting functionality to those of us that have that financial responsibility?
It does. And what I love about this, it reports back in a couple different ways. It has a board of directors report that really gives a financial look at the operations of the organization, from every single dollar that gone in, for every fundraiser that took place, for every reporting system that were required to have it for that month. And it also allows them to have testimonies, something that they can point their finger at and say, okay, here's some of the accomplishment for the month. We also have a system in there that does the profit and loss, so you can do that on a monthly basis if you wanted to, just to know where the organization stands. And then the last portion is we allow them to do a supplemental 990, which is what the IRS requires every year for them. And allows them now to keep that in a very technology format that says to them, okay, know where you are every month. So when you provide this to your CPA at the end of the year, you're simply just printing this off, and then you can follow it that way.
That sounds fantastic.
I remind our listeners, you're listening to Buckhead Business Radio Show. You can tune in live every Tuesday at 10 a.m. and go to our website at buckheadbusinessradiox.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at buckheadradiox.com. We're currently talking with Terrence Ross. He is founder of Rita 2.0, the software corporation that develops foundations for the nonprofits. I got to ask this. We asked Karen what was in her name at IAG. What's in the name of Rita?
Believe it or not, it stands for Ross Income Technology Application.
Okay. Right. But it comes together as Rita Tech.
And let me tell you, I'm in love with it too.
Yeah. I'd say so. Yeah.
That sounds good. Rich?
So, yeah, talk to us during the beta testing. You have a client story you might be able to share, or.
One that comes to mind is a young lady who started a organization who had been a victim of domestic violence, believe it or not. And she wanted to create a national association that kind of dealt with women who had been victimized by that process. And what was amazing about that, in order for her to be able to access some of the capital, she needed to make sure she had her story down in a way that somebody could read that. And she said by using our software, she was able to not only put all of her thoughts down into action, but she could put dollar cents to the experience that she had been through. And I thought that was so amazing, because what we talked about with Rita was that we thought that Rita would be a movement, to be honest with you. Our goal is to at least turn somewhere between 1,000 to 3,000 nonprofit organization into social enterprise organization, so that not only their mission can be heard, but can be expanded. Mm-hmm. And what I love about this particular case with this young lady is that now she's going to be going after the NFL, asking them to participate in some of these different functions that her organization is providing. And she now has a platform to do that. And I tell people, Rita has a social conscience, is what I love about her. And any nonprofit, no matter what your mission is, this organization and this product would allow you to create enterprise ideals that would help further that mission.
It's very inspiring. I don't know if you can share some of those numbers. Like you mentioned, those three different options. Do you have price points in place, or a trial service, or and you're officially in launch right now in alpha? Or
We are. Believe it or not, our price point for the beta section of this is going to be $399.
Okay.
For the pro version of it, it will be $699, and then for the enterprise version, it will be $999.
Okay.
And one of the reasons why we kept the numbers extremely low is because we really want to work with those organizations on developing those enterprise ideas that go into the software. Hmm.
What I think what's so compelling here is that you have this tremendous history of running nonprofits, being in that space for so many years. So it's kind of like a match made in heaven. Yes or yes?
It is. It really is. And I tell people, when we started to develop this process, believe it or not, Aaron, it was, we wanted to make sure that nonprofit organizations did not have to choose between their passion and profits anymore.
Oh, wow. That's a good line. I should have gotten that one.
Yeah, he just trumped you on that one there. Yeah. But I have to ask too, you know, when you're involved with a nonprofit, you're doing very good work there, and it feels good. Here you are supporting a nonprofit, so it must feel doubly good on the mission you're on now with Rita Tech 2.0.
It really is. I mean, obviously, we're thinking about legacy now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we believe this software is going to do extremely well. But one of the things we hope to come out of this is to be able to fund nonprofit organizations and their social mission to expand that. So some of the proceeds from Rita is going to be set aside to do that, in the form of grants and loan to nonprofits.
Wow.
As long as they have an enterprise idea that's going to support their mission.
No, that's great. And certainly doing great work at Rita Tech 2.0. You're changing the world. You're changing how business is done with nonprofits. But when you're not doing that, when you're away from work and you're not developing software, what is something you like to do to stay motivated or stay grounded?
You know what? I'm reminded every week on how I need to work on my golf game. So believe it or not, we're going to host next year a charity shootout where we're going to pin nonprofit organizations against each other and raise capital and allow the cash prizes to be used to further some of the nonprofit's mission.
Well, that sounds great. It'd be a great opportunity for you to come back on the show and talk about the success of the golf charity shootout and the nonprofits who are involved. That'd be wonderful.
And I'm looking for some ringers at this point as
I'm telling you, bring in a couple of pros to give us some lessons. Actually, we're going to close out and ask our other guests the same question, what you all do when you're not wearing your hats. But Terrence, beforehand, remind our listeners the best way to find out about your software and your program.
You know, you can contact us a couple different ways. Obviously, you can go to our website, which is www.ritasoftware.com, or you can contact us at 404-267-1851. Is a local number for us.
Well, excited about your venture and what you're bringing to the marketplace. Thanks for being here on the show, and good things upcoming for you in the future, I know.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited about it. Thank you for having me.
So let's chat with, as we close out, each of our guests. And so, Aaron, what do you do when you're not mowing lawns or...
I'm a big LSU football fan.
Okay.
And I'm excited that football's
season
about to start. Yeah. And I really am passionate, as many people in the South are, in SEC football.
Oh, yeah.
I also am recently a grandfather for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Congratulations.
So I have a little 2-year-old grandson.
Wow.
And everything people say about being a grandparent is true. Oh, yeah. It's more fun than being a parent because you can send the little fellow back home.
Well, it's all fun, right?
Yeah. It's all fun.
Without the work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We know where to find you on Saturdays watching football with your grandson.
Sitting on my knee.
Yes. Road trips or tailgates for LSU?
I do have season tickets. Okay. And I'm looking very forward to the LSU-Auburn game, which is the third game of the season. It'll be a pivotal game of how everything turns out, I think.
He called it right here, so make a note, sports fans, right?
Well, we do appreciate you joining us, taking the time out of your busy schedule and your speaking tour and your book writing and everything to join us here on Buckhead Business Radio Show. And we wish you much success going forward.
Thank you very much. Y'all have a great show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're not still mowing lawns, though, are you?
only my own lawn.
You retired your lawnmower. Yeah, he is not available. Don't call him for your lawn care. Yeah.
And Karen, and closing thoughts, like when you're not out there investigating folks or testifying in federal court, you know, what do you like to do to kind of take your mind off?
Well, I like to play tennis.
Okay.
On a couple of tennis teams, and you enjoy your grandson and. I've got a few kids, 3 kids. They range from 7 to 17, so I'm pretty much doing anything that they're doing.
You play tennis with the children?
I wish. I wish they would, but they all have their other sports.
Well, so if they're listening, go out there and hit a few balls with mom.
They better not be listening. They're in school.
Well, they can go back and listen to the podcast once it's posted online. And so, but we can find you out on the tennis court here around town, playing on some tournaments and whooping the competition, I bet.
Yeah, well, I try.
Yeah, very good. And so wish you much success going forward over there at IAG Forensics. Thank you for taking your time today to speak with us. I think it's a great subject matter that all businesses can learn and certainly can take some time to, you know, get their business right before they, Karen, visits your business campus out there.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Rich, another good show.
I concur, yeah. And we are out of time for other announcements and all that good stuff, but just go to the website, Buckhead Business Radio X. You'll find all of our show lineup and upcoming shows and our whole programming. So we'll see you next week on this edition of Tuesday Mornings with Buckhead Business Radio X. Rich Casanova once again. Do well, be good.